trials and labor camps became central to his efforts to establish himself as an unassailable dictator in the 1930s, providing a man with paranoid tendencies ever greater cause to fear lurking enemies. Stalin's systematic murder of thousands of his own military and intelligence corps in the 1930s and 1940s, a centerpiece of his perpetual strategy to eliminate opposition and subversion, would have doomed the Soviet Union had it not been for its capacity to produce weapons and absorb casualties. His non-aggression pact with Hitler in 1939 freed him to annex eastern Poland, then including western Belorussia and Ukraine, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and parts of Romania, while leaving Soviet borders unprotected, yet nearly caused his own country's annihilation after Germany invaded in 1941. After the war, Stalin's efforts to extend Soviet power were guided by a crude, unwavering, and empirically false Marxian belief in the inevitability of capitalist intramural conflict and collapse. Confident that time was on his side, however, he was also pragmatic and patient. As a diplomat, he excelled. Lurking beneath his unpretentious facade, Kennan observed after meeting him in 1945, were great depths of calculation, ambition, love of power, jealousy, cruelty, and sly vindictiveness, as well as diabolical skill as a tactician. Attlee said of Stalin that he reminded me of the Renaissance despots, no principles, any methods. Of his style there was no flowery language, always yes or no, though you could only count on him if it was no. Stalin adapted his demeanor to his opponent's capacity for resisting his will. With Moscow's Eastern European allies, he was typically condescending, offensive, and brutally direct. Tito's Lieutenant Milovan Gilas, who in 1962 published Conversations with Stalin, referred to him as a monster, who, while adhering to abstract, absolute, and fundamentally utopian ideas, in practice had no criterion but success, and this meant violence and physical and spiritual extermination. With Churchill he needled and flattered as he saw fit. With Roosevelt he was almost invariably charming, even when unwilling to concede substance, owing to the paucity of issues on which he could afford a rupture with Washington. Part of Stalin's negotiating prowess owed to his choice of deputy. As Smith put it, Stalin cultivated the myth that there were two schools of thought in the Politburo, a conciliatory one headed by Stalin, and a tough one by Molotov. This was one of the oldest gags on the Soviet confusion propaganda circuit. Molotov so infuriated his counterparts with his sullen stubbornness that they were almost grateful to have their demands denied less unpleasantly by his boss. Molotov was almost always the same, with hardly a shade of variety, regardless of what or who was under consideration, Gilas observed. Nothing like the temperamentally dexterous Stalin. Hooded, calm, never raising his voice, Stalin avoided the repeated negatives of Molotov, which were so exasperating to listen to, observed Anthony Eden, reflecting on Yalta. By more subtle methods he got what he wanted without having to be so obdurate. Stalin was, for Eden, the best negotiator he ever encountered. George Marshall, never at ease with small talk, briefly returned Stalin's pleasantries, recalling with great interest their previous meeting at the Tehran Conference in 1943, where amphibious and cross-river operations had been discussed. "Yes," Stalin interjected, "the Second Front." Marshall had wished to remind Stalin of the two countries' recent historic collaboration, but the Second Front held different meanings for the two men. From Stalin's perspective, it had been deliberately, devastatingly, and unforgivably late. America and Britain, he believed, delayed launching it for years in order that Germany and the Soviet Union might first grind each other into rubble and impotence. Stalin, of course, had also used this tactic, letting Germans slaughter the Warsaw Poles in August 1944. Marshall steered the meeting toward business. He would, he advised Stalin, speak frankly, not as a diplomat, but as he had been trained, as a soldier. He explained that he was very concerned, even somewhat depressed at the extent and depth of misunderstandings and differences revealed at this conference. The Soviet Union, he said, had been held in high esteem among the American people at the end of the war. But since that time, the Soviet government had not kept faith with agreements and was hindering progress on new ones. The American lend-lease arrangement with the Soviet Union, Marshall reminded Stalin, had been the most generous of all, and the unwillingness of the Soviets to settle their obligations, such as the return of merchant ships and war vessels, was having a very bad effect on the United States Congress and on public opinion. Now, here in Moscow, an atmosphere of suspicion and distrust was making agreement virtually impossible. Marshall was indeed speaking frankly, even brutally, as he later termed it. Impassively, Stalin puffed on a cigarette, looking down to the side, occasionally into Marshall's eyes as he listened to the American and his translator. A red pen in his right hand throughout, he doodled wolves' heads on a notepad in plain sight of his guests, a practice he was known to have cultivated some time ago for the purpose of disconcerting them. Harriman had experienced it in his first audience with him at the beginning of the war. Marshall turned to the main issue dividing Washington and Moscow, Germany. They were not making progress on any of the central matters, demilitarization, reparations, or the country's future economic and political architecture. Germany had brought the Soviet Union and the United States together in a common cause from 1941 to 1945. But now that it was caged between the eastern and western halves of the continent, each under the effective control of their respective militaries, it served only to magnify the consequences of their clashing ideologies and geostrategic interests. Little of substance or even of clear meaning regarding Germany's future had been decided among FDR, Churchill, and Stalin at Yalta 2 years prior, in spite, or because, of it being by far the most consequential issue the three governments would have to resolve. Stalin had at the time been content to wait. He expected the correlation of forces to move in his favor, as they did, when the Red Army beat Eisenhower to Berlin. Now, here in Moscow, Marshall said, there was a misconception that the United States intended to dismember Germany. But his government did not have any such intention. It, in fact, desired the opposite. It wanted the country unified economically, allowing the more industrial West to exchange goods freely with the agricultural East. But it also believed that a powerful central German government would constitute a real danger for the peace of the world. Marshall further believed, yet did not say, that the main source of this danger was the Kremlin-controlled KPD, Kommunistische Partei Deutschlands, German Communist Party, which had held power in the East since forcibly absorbing and dismantling the SPD Social Democratic Party in 1946. Marshall now directed his frustration at his interlocutor for the past 6 weeks. Mr. Molotov, he said, had charged that the British-American bizonal arrangement was in violation of Potsdam. But it was as plain as this table that the United States and Great Britain had been forced to take this action in defense of their own taxpayers by reason of the failure to establish economic unity in Germany. As for reparations, Marshall continued, Molotov was exaggerating what the United States had received from the American zone, while refusing himself even to provide any figures as to what the Soviet Union had received. The two delegations had, further, reached an impasse on the demilitarization treaty. There was also the wider context, Marshall added, Europe. We are, he said, frankly determined to do what we can to assist those countries which are suffering from economic deterioration. If unchecked, this might lead to economic collapse and the consequent elimination of any chance of democratic survival. Trying to close on a positive note, Marshall reiterated his desire to rebuild the basis of cooperation that had existed during the war. He had, he said, come to Generalissimo Stalin with that hope, feeling that if they cleared away some of the suspicion, it would be a good beginning for the restoration of that understanding. Stalin nodded. Marshall, he said, was quite right that only on the basis of frankness and sincerity could cooperation and friendship be developed. As to Lend-Lease, he confessed, there was occasional sloppiness in the operation of the Soviet government. It was very busy here because we suffered such great losses in the war. This might be the reason for the delays. But there was another side to the Lend-Lease question, he told Marshall, namely the credits which had been linked to Lend-Lease. 2 years ago, Stalin explained, in response to Ambassador Harriman's question regarding what orders the Soviet government was prepared to place in the United States and what credits it needed to settle them, his government had submitted a memorandum requesting $3 to $6 billion. $6 billion, Stalin said, had been long promised. Now, after 2 years had passed, no reply had yet been received. This was, he suggested pointedly, possibly due to sloppiness on the part of the United States. Novikov was stunned. $6 billion? I only knew of a promise of a $1 billion loan, he later recorded, and I was not the only one struck by Stalin's bitter reproach. Marshall was whispering in Smith's ear as Stalin spoke. Smith scribbled furiously. He reached across the table and handed Novikov a note. Mr. Novikov, it read, you know too well that it's not so. $6 billion have never been promised. Please explain it to Mr. Stalin. Novikov translated and handed the message to Molotov. Without moving a brow, Molotov put the sheet into a folder. He did not say a word to Stalin, whose strange memory lapse haunted me, Novikov noted. What I saw was an elderly, very elderly, tired man who, likely, was carrying his great burden of responsibility with great difficulty. Stalin would correct himself, but only to the extent of conceding that 1 year had passed, rather than two. Stalin moved on to Germany. The Council of Foreign Ministers, he said, had no authorization to repeal the agreements entered into by the three governments. He looked at Bolin. Mr. Bolin must remember those conversations at Yalta, where he translated for FDR, when all the Americans, including President Roosevelt, Secretary of State Edward Stettinius, and Hopkins, had said they thought the Soviet demand for $10 billion in reparations was very small, and spread, over 20 years this would not be hard for the Germans. But now there was apparently a different point of view, that despite the Soviet Union having removed barely $2 billion worth of assets, no more reparations would be permitted, not even from current production. This the Soviet Union could not accept. The Soviet people, Stalin said, had suffered terribly at the hands of the Germans. He had no pity, sympathy, or love for them. Reparations were right and necessary. As for the subject of German unity, the Soviet Union stood like the British and Americans for economic unity. But that was not enough, Stalin said. Economic unity was not feasible without political unity. We are against a strong, centralized German government, Stalin clarified. We want only one that should stand above and not below the Länder, state governments. But we must not repeat the same mistakes as Napoleon, who set up scattered German governments. He thereby gained a tactical advantage from a temporarily weakened Germany, but strengthened the hand of German militarists who dreamed of reuniting Germany. Napoleon's action in effect gave birth to Bismarck and the Franco-Prussian War. If these errors were now repeated, the Soviet Union risked losing control of the instrument of German unity and handing it over to the militarists and chauvinists. The German people would then soon follow another dangerous and bellicose leader down the path of reconsolidation. However incoherent its elements, the contours of Soviet policy toward Germany had been largely settled for a year now. Stalin had no inclination to reopen it. In May 1946, 38 top Soviet officials, including General Georgi Zhukov and Deputy Foreign Minister Solomon Lazovsky, had submitted their conclusions on Bern's proposal for German demilitarization and great power security guarantees in Europe. They were unequivocal. Moscow must reject it. The United States, they argued, was trying to drive the Soviet Union out of Germany to secure its economic domination of that country, and to preserve its military potential in Europe as a necessary base for carrying out their aggressive aims in the future. Stalin concluded that Washington was reneging on Roosevelt's Tehran commitment to withdraw U.S. troops within 2 years of the war's end, seeking instead Soviet sanction for the U.S. playing the same role in European affairs as the USSR. And once Soviet troops were out of Germany, Zhukov warned, the Americans would demand a withdrawal from Poland, a critical military corridor with Germany, and ultimately from the Balkans. Within a few years, there will be a German-Anglo-American war against the USSR. In this light, Marshall's calls to rebuild Germany and to end reparations were two sides of the same coin. America intended to take over Germany, rearm it, and turn it against Russia. Marshall might as well have been pushing on a closed door from the inside. Stalin would oppose any plan that precluded Soviet control over the western half of Germany. All of Germany must be ours, Stalin told Bulgarian and Yugoslav leaders in 1946. That is Soviet, communist. Stalin kept talking to Marshall only because he wanted Washington to shoulder the responsibility for Germany's division, if such could not be avoided. Yet Stalin had, in fact, supported dismembering Germany before he opposed it. Stalin was, in 1941, the first of the Allied leaders to press for it, wanting Germany, according to a Molotov cable to Maisky in London, divided into a series of more or less independent states, so as to provide a guarantee for the peace of European states in the future, a message that Maisky relayed to a skeptical Eden. At Yalta, Stalin had with him specific proposals from his advisers for a division of the country into 4, 5, and 7 states, but pressed only for the word dismemberment to be added to the German surrender formula. With American support, the Soviets prevailed over British concerns that it would rouse German nationalism and resolved to fight. After Yalta, however, Stalin did an about-face. Fearing that the absence of a central authority in Germany might hinder his ability to extract reparations from the industrialized west of the country, he ordered his delegations to the March 1945 meeting of Allied Foreign Service officials in London to take the line that dismemberment was only to be a last resort if Germany could not be brought into line through other means. Thereafter, he and Molotov would publicly blame the Americans and the British for championing it. In the final months of the war, meanwhile, Stalin groomed Walter Ulbricht and his KPD Communist Party to organize the Soviet occupation zone in Germany. The diminutive, Lenin-bearded 51-year-old Ulbricht had risen through the communist hierarchy in the 1920s, fleeing Germany in 1933 and settling in Moscow via Paris and Prague in 1938. There he avoided the fate of so many less adroit Communist Party members and activists by backing Stalin's every move, from show trials to the Nazi-Soviet pact. Politburo member Lavrenty Beria, master of the Soviet international security system, called him the greatest idiot he had ever seen. But Stalin found him a most useful one after the war's end. Thanks to the treachery of British M16 intelligence agent Kim Philby, the Soviets were also able to identify and then capture or murder most of Eastern Germany's Catholic wartime anti-Nazi and anti-communist resistance leaders. So Stalin was well prepared for the present stalemate with the Americans, who had few natural allies in the East. What he was unprepared for was the role his own actions would play in hardening the hostilities between Eastern and Western Germany, making impossible the progressive unification under communist leadership that he was now seeking. While telling Ulbricht in early 1946 that he wanted Germany to be democratic, allowing approved non-communist parties to participate, he also demanded a purge of the state administration, public ownership of enterprises, expropriation of big landowners, and obedience to directives from Moscow. In April, he forced a merger of the KPD and the Social Democratic SPD into the KPD-dominated Socialist Unity Party, Sozialistische Einheitspartei Deutschlands, SED. This only increased anti-Russian anger in Germany, for Berliners referred to communists as Zedisten, sadists. Facing a huge anti-communist electoral turnout on October 20th of that year, particularly in Soviet-occupied East Berlin, Stalin now stiffened his opposition to Washington's federalization proposals, which would have strengthened local control and weakened his own. and in the wake of the crushing defeat, the SED finishing third with under 20% of the vote, he became ruthlessly pragmatic. To the shock and dismay of SED leaders who met with him in January 1947, he pressed them to abandon their policy of elimination in order to avoid a scenario in which all former fascists are pushed into the adversarial camp. "The Soviet zone has its own fascists," Stalin said. "Can they not organize their party under a different name?" He did not mean persuading them to the side of the SED. They would not be willing. But just to not push them all to the Americans. The SED chairmen were appalled. "Nazis are in administrative positions in the Western zones," Otto Grothwald said. "But such a course of action from us would not be understood to the masses working in the West." Wilhelm Pieck nodded. What Stalin was asking was impossible.
"Impossible?" Stalin asked.
"It seems possible to me." Peck was incredulous. The SED had to continue the struggle against active Nazis, he insisted.
"But what about distinguishing not very active Nazis from very active Nazis?" Stalin put back. The goal, he explained, was winning over the population in the West.
To that end, the first task was to get the Allies to agree to a nationwide plebiscite on some carefully worded question related to German unity, when it would assist communist expansion. "If we succeed in completing this first stage, that will be well and good. And if we don't, we'll accept the consolidation of German administration in the Soviet zone." The critical matter was ensuring that the cause of German unity not be transferred from our hands to the hands of the bourgeoisie. This suggested Stalin was willing to suffer Western Germany remaining under Allied control, if it proved necessary to ensuring that the East stayed communist. As for Washington's policy on Germany, it had, since 1945, lurched just as radically as Moscow's. The Truman administration was now in revolt against the Morgenthau mindset that had held sway, however tenuously, in Washington a mere 2.5 years prior, which viewed a united, industrially revived Germany as a continued threat to Europe. FDR's State Department never supported Morgenthau's plan for deindustrialization and dismemberment, believing it would provide a ready-made program for nationalistic agitators. Instead, it supported only decentralization or federalization as a means of containing German nationalism and militarism. Once Truman became president, he condemned Morgenthau's meddling and put the State Department back in control of foreign policy. Europe's economic crisis now made Morgenthau's ideas look reckless. Real gross domestic product, GDP, in Britain was tumbling, down 2.6% for the year, while inflation in the United States was soaring, 14.4% for the year, pushing up British import costs. Production, concluded a widely circulated report by former President Herbert Hoover following a European trip in February, was the one path to recovery in Europe. "And the whole economy of Europe," he insisted, "is interlinked with the German economy." His ally Vandenberg called Germany the core of the whole European problem. Despite the massive wartime damage Germany sustained, reflected in the destruction of 40% of its housing stock, a remarkable 80% of the country's industrial plant capacity remained intact. Germany exited the war with a greater functioning machine tool stock than it had on entering it. Much of it new. One-third of industrial equipment was less than 5 years old, up from one-tenth in 1939. Only raw material shortages and political uncertainty held back its recovery, and Europe's. The United States could therefore, Hoover concluded, keep Germany in these economic chains, but it will also keep Europe in rags. Clay and Dulles agreed with Hoover, although the two disagreed bitterly over how to manage Germany. Clay, who considered Dulles overly indulgent of the French, wanted to maintain territorial integrity of the country and avoid rupture with the Soviets. Dulles wanted to put the Ruhr under international control and use the resources of the Rhine Basin to jumpstart a new federated Western Europe. This idea was beginning to capture the imagination of a State Department in search of ways to give substance to the Truman Doctrine. For his part, Stalin naturally opposed German reindustrialization, particularly when its object was to bolster European capitalism. 6 weeks of talks in Moscow had not even begun to close the gap between Soviet and American visions for Germany. Yet Stalin had one final proposal. "If our views on this subject cannot be reconciled," he put to Marshall, "there was a way out. A compromise. Let the German people decide through a plebiscite what they wished." Marshall recoiled. He knew full well where a plebiscite would lead. He had seen the results in Poland last July, in a baldly manipulated referendum that cleared the way for communist control. General elections followed in January 1947, in the run-up to which anti-communist Peasant Party supporters were arrested by the thousands and their candidates stricken from electoral lists. Yet in order to prevail, the communists still had to resort to mass ballot stuffing. Churchill had fought a lonely last-ditch diplomatic offensive against Stalin at Yalta to preserve an independent Poland as a barricade against Soviet westward expansion. But FDR, more concerned with securing Soviet UN membership and entry into the Pacific War, capitulated to Stalin's insistence on Allied recognition of the Soviet-backed provisional Polish government and toothless Western monitoring of future elections. Now in Moscow, Marshall was determined to defend another such barricade, a few hundred miles to the west, in Germany. All Marshall and Stalin could agree on was that neither the United States nor the Soviet Union could risk the possibility of Germany becoming an ally of the other. "We must insist on keeping Western Germany free of communistic control," Kennan would later urge. Marshall would call "a domination of all Germany by the Soviets the greatest threat to the security of all Western nations." Thus, after 90 minutes of serial monologue, the two men resolved nothing. Marshall was grim, yet Stalin remained disconcertingly calm, almost detached. "It is wrong to give so tragic an interpretation to our present disagreements," he told Marshall. "They were," he said, "like quarrels between family members." "Differences over Germany were," he added, pointedly replacing the familial analogy with a martial one, "only the first skirmishes and brushes of reconnaissance forces." "Agreement might come in time," he assured Marshall, "when people had exhausted themselves in dispute," Stalin said. "They recognized the necessity for compromise. We may agree the next time," he added encouragingly, "or, if not then, the time after that." His manner suggested what researchers would later identify as signs of hostile diplomatic intent, unwarranted positive sentiment and a focus on future possibilities as opposed to present circumstances suggest imminent betrayal. Marshall was now alarmed. Not that Stalin continued to disagree with the American position, but that he was content to let disagreement drag on while Germany and Europe convulsed. "The worse the better," a phrase famously attributed to the 19th-century radical Russian writer Nikolai Chernyshevsky, later to Lenin, appeared to be the Soviet leader's view. Marshall now saw that Molotov's mulishness could not be explained away by his character. The foreign minister had been carrying out his boss's orders. The Soviets, Marshall concluded, were not negotiating in good faith. They were doing everything possible to achieve a complete breakdown in Europe. "It was the Moscow conference," said Ambassador Robert Murphy, Clay's political advisor and the top U.S. diplomat in Germany, "which really rang down the Iron Curtain." Skeptical of prospects for cooperation with the Soviets before the conference, Murphy would thereafter see them as wholly untrustworthy and decry anything resembling American appeasement. 4. Plan. The European recovery program, Marshall would later say, was an outgrowth of my disillusionment over the Moscow conference. He had considered inaugurating it at the conclusion of the conference, but decided that some delay was wise. "I did not want it to appear that the Western Allies had come to Moscow with a prior agreement to go ahead without Soviet cooperation. There were also differences with Britain over reparations, etc., which he did not want exposed. He spent his flight home digesting notes on the continent's crumbling economy and sketching out ideas to prevent the complete breakdown of Western Europe. Hitler's conquests had shown the dangers posed by a hostile power controlling the industrial resources of Western Europe, which were second in importance only to those of the United States. Washington, therefore, to Marshall's mind, now had to act on its own, without Russia or, if necessary, against it. Reporting to Truman on April 27, 1947, the evening following his return to Washington, he insisted there was no time to be lost in fashioning the administration's response. The next day, Marshall gave a radio broadcast reciting the melancholy catalogue of disagreements between Washington and Moscow. "Disintegrating forces," he said, "are becoming evident. Europe could no longer wait for compromise. The patient is sinking while the doctors deliberate." Though no course of treatment had been set, the bureaucracy had begun to mobilize while Marshall was away. On April 21st, the Coordinating Committee of State, War, and Navy Department staff, SWNCC, weighed in. The output which Acheson presented to Marshall upon his return was a grand muddle, giving every impression that it was the product of a committee of disparate interests working in haste, as it was. U.S. economic aims, security needs, geopolitical ambitions, and humanitarian concerns were all heaped into the mix. The conclusion is inescapable, the report said, that under present programs and policies, the world will not be able to continue to buy United States exports at the 1946-47 rate beyond another 12 to 18 months. The anticipated substantial decline in the United States export surplus would have a depressing effect on business activity and employment in the United States. U.S. gross national product, GNP, had fallen 11.6% in 1946, driven by the collapse of government spending after the war. The President's Council on Economic Advisers was now predicting a further small decline in the coming 12 months. A revival of the European economies would be critical to limiting the downturn. Minimizing the cost and duration of United States economic assistance to accomplish it would demand coordination of European national recovery programs. It would further require a substantial increase in trade with Soviet-dominated areas, provided such trade can be arranged on terms compatible with the economic and political independence of Western-oriented areas. But this was blather. Trade could not be required conditional on it being politically agreeable. Either Western recovery required Eastern trade, or it didn't. The United States, the report also offered obliquely, will probably continue to undertake to alleviate starvation and suffering as such, where this action is consistent with U.S. interests. This was a meaningless observation and tepid recommendation rolled into one, concocted both to acknowledge and disparage calls for the administration to play Red Cross. Most passionate was the urging for the United States to take care that other nations do not pass under the influence of any potentially hostile nation. Economic weakness made states prone to subversive and boring from within tactics or the threat of overwhelming force. Though the Soviet Union is never mentioned by name in this section, preventing advancement of communist influence is highlighted as a primary aim of the president's call to aid Greece and Turkey. However inadequate was the document as a basis for Marshall to confront an unsympathetic Congress, engage a war-wearied public, and orchestrate an economic metamorphosis among its allies, the SWNCC had put forward all the elements that Marshall would soon have to meld into a plan: supporting European nations that could resist communism, preventing a humanitarian crisis, and confronting a threat to American economic recovery. What was missing was a workable blueprint, articulated such that it could survive the backlash it would generate at home and abroad. The first major step in creating a blueprint followed in short order. On April 29th, just after his radio pronouncement, Marshall summoned Kennan, whom he had met only twice during the war, and directed him to leave his post at the National War College. At Forrestal's urging, Marshall was appointing him head of the new Policy Planning Staff, PPS, a State Department think tank that would soon come to play a central role in the Cold War. You can't operate and plan at the same time, Marshall would later offer by way of explanation for the new body. Forrestal had been calling for American economic leadership to rebuild Europe in response to the communist threat, and it would be Kennan's job to figure out how to exercise it. I don't want to wait for Congress to beat me over the head, Marshall told him from behind his polished, paper-free desk. Despite the immensity of the assignment, he ordered Kennan to report back within 2 weeks. No further guidance was offered, beyond a directive to avoid trivia. Among the challenges Kennan would face were staff and space, of which he had none. He hastily recruited personnel, among which Walt Rostow and Charles Kindleberger, Clayton protégés who would go on to become great figures in their own right. The group labored around the clock in commandeered conference rooms that, in James Reston's words, had about as much character as a chewing gum factory. For Kennan, who felt out of his depth on economic matters and who feared the reaction the report would engender from critics who knew them far better than he, the experience was an intellectual agony more intensive than anything I had previously experienced. Constant carping in the press over what Truman should and should not do in Europe only stoked the pressure. At one stressful point, the exhausted new PPS head excused himself from a meeting, left the building, and wept. He knew, however, that succumbing to discord or pessimistic voices was not an option. We had to come up with something, Kennan reflected years later. And we did. The belief that economics should occupy a prime place in the American diplomatic arsenal took root at the turn of the century, with Secretary of State John Hay's enunciation of open-door principles for global trade with China. Hay argued for a free open market and equal trading opportunity for merchants of all nationalities operating in the country. Such a principle would, he believed, benefit the U.S. economy while preventing disputes among the powers operating in China. President Woodrow Wilson globalized the principle with the third of his 14 points after World War I, calling for the removal, so far as possible, of all economic barriers among nations. American bankers helped stabilize Europe's economy in the 1920s with the discreet support of the Harding and Coolidge administrations. Currency and trade wars in the 1930s stimulated more activist executive branch action. Treasury targeted global monetary reform, and the State Department non-discriminatory trade as elements vital to international cooperation and economic stability. Acheson, Harriman, and Clayton all tilted toward the Democratic Party in the 1930s, not in support of the New Deal, but of Secretary of State Cordell Hull's free trade agenda and in opposition to the GOP's slide toward protectionism. Truman, like FDR, was receptive to the notion that economic intervention could and should be used aggressively, at times as an alternative to military intervention to secure vital American national interests. The administrations differed, however, in two primary regards. The first was that FDR allowed the Treasury to take the lead in the crafting of foreign economic policy, which owed more to his friendship with Morgenthau than to any predilection for one bureaucracy over another. Truman chose to lodge such powers in the State Department. Several of his wise men, as they would come to be called, were dissenting voices in the previous administration. Acheson, who had served in both Treasury and State under FDR, had been a determined opponent of Morgenthau's and White's tenacious application of financial leverage over tapped-out Britain. They had, he lamented, envisaged a victory in war where both enemies and allies were prostrate, enemies by military action, allies by bankruptcy. Blaming the rise of totalitarian military states on the collapse of the 19th century economic order over which Britain had presided, he was now determined to help erect the new American-led one. Kennan, who had been disgusted by what he saw as naive and misguided pro-Soviet sentiment in FDR's treasury, was eager to help chart Europe's recovery in part by ending hopeless efforts to cooperate with Moscow. The second difference was over handling of a defeated Germany. FDR backed Morgenthau in his plan to pastoralize the country, though later evading association with it, whereas Truman backed Secretary of War Henry Stimson, an ardent opponent of the plan, in believing that an economically strong, productive Germany was essential to the future stability of Europe. Morgenthau had sought to block Germany's reemergence as an economic and military power by dismantling its industry and distributing the pieces among its victims. The German people, he said, could live on soup kitchens if necessary. An alarmed Stimson cautioned against taking mass vengeance, emphasizing that speed of reconstruction is of great importance if we hope to avoid dangerous convulsions in Europe. Others warned that the Morgenthau plan would prolong the war, precipitate famine, raise occupation costs, and aid Soviet interests at American expense. Yet FDR allowed it to form the basis of what became U.S. occupation policy. Joint Chiefs of Staff Directive JCS 1067 in September 1944. The directive instructed the American military governor in Germany to take no steps, A, looking toward the economic rehabilitation of Germany, or B, designed to maintain or strengthen the German economy. On the ground in Britain in the spring of 1945, Clay would find it an enormous source of frustration. Lewis Douglas, his advisor on occupation financing, fumed that it prevented the most skilled workers in Europe from producing as much as they can for a continent which is desperately short of everything. The directive, Douglas said, had been assembled by economic idiots. Morgenthau, its inspiration, didn't know shit from apple butter, in Truman's cruder verdict. Morgenthau was a self-described apple farmer with no background in economics. In appointing his longtime Hyde Park neighbor Treasury Secretary in 1934, FDR, quipped Gladys Strauss, a prominent New York donor, had managed to find the only Jew in the world who doesn't know a thing about money. Truman maligned Morgenthau for interfering in German affairs and forced him to resign in July 1945, a few months after stepping into the Oval Office. The War Department did its best to soften both the letter and the spirit of the directive. With the approval of the Treasury and the State Department, Assistant Secretary McCloy added a provision allowing for the production or maintenance of goods and services necessary to prevent epidemics or major civil unrest. Still, Morgenthau, even after leaving office, and his allies kept up the pressure on the War Department to maintain a hard peace. Truman faced an additional economic challenge that his predecessor had not had to reckon with in wartime. At the end of the conflict, there was a conviction in Washington, particularly conspicuous in Congress, that dangers lay in simply calibrating military resources to the degree of threat perception. Unrestrained military spending was, in this view, the handmaiden of high inflation, perpetual budget deficits, confiscatory taxes, and heavy-handed economic controls. The Russians, many believed, had a plan to force the United States to bankrupt itself through ever-expanding foreign entanglements. This had two important effects. The first was on military doctrine itself. In geographer Halford Mackinder's terminology, defending the world's rimlands from the threat posed by Russian domination of the heartland could be accomplished in principle either by a strategy of a comprehensive perimeter defense or a much more limited strongpoint defense. Kennan, in his soon-to-be-famous Foreign Affairs article, The Sources of Soviet Conduct, implicitly backed the former, calling for the United States to confront the Russians with unalterable counterforce at every point where they show signs of encroaching upon the interests of a peaceful and stable world. Yet this strategy assumed unlimited overdraft facilities to finance it, an assumption at odds with the view that profligacy was itself a danger. Kennan appeared to have largely abandoned this expansive conception of containment by the time his article was published in July, shifting toward an approach that focused on threats that combined hostility with capability. This change in view brought him closer to the pragmatic Acheson. The defense of critical points on the map rather than entire lines emerged as a tenet of enemy containment largely because of the domestic political requirement of cost containment. Marshall himself came to hold that concentration rather than dispersal of our forces appears to be the wisest course, especially in view of our present limitations. But Kennan could also justify it on the grounds that, in his belief, Stalin had no intention of starting a war with the United States, if Eastern Europe's subservience could be achieved through other means. Forrestal believed America's atomic monopoly afforded it several years of opportunity to assume risks otherwise unacceptable. These risks could be kept at tolerable levels through low-cost initiatives such as propaganda and psychological warfare. The second effect is that promotion of economic recovery and rehabilitation in Europe and later Japan emerged as a central element of containment on the grounds that it would be far less costly than military readiness and engagement. These ideas had already been brewing in 1945. At Potsdam, Stimson and McCloy had called for the creation of a completely coordinated plan to be adopted for the economic rehabilitation of Europe as a whole. Harriman, a Russia hawk after his war years dealing with the Kremlin, had urged massive European reconstruction aid to both FDR and Truman. But by 1947, the ideas were ready to take center stage. "Our resources are not unlimited," Truman would state 6 months after ushering in his namesake doctrine. "We must apply them where they can serve most effectively to bring production, freedom, and confidence back to the world." By the summer of 1948, Robert Lovett, who would succeed Acheson, would restate the Truman Doctrine with as much force as Truman had stated it over a year prior. The line must be drawn somewhere, or the United States would find itself in the position of underwriting the security of the whole world. "We lack sufficient resources simultaneously to finance the economic recovery of Europe, to furnish arms and equipment to the countries which request them, and to build up our own military strength." Army Secretary Royal insisted he would need a 20% boost to the military budget if Congress voted down a European aid plan. Forrestal characterized American priorities in Europe as economic stability, political stability, and military stability, in about that order. He even bluntly stated that the government was keeping its military expenditures below the levels which our military leaders must in good conscience estimate as the minimum which would in themselves ensure national security. U.S. defensive expenditures had fallen from $83 billion in fiscal year 1945 to $42.7 billion in 1946 and $12.8 billion in 1947. Over that period, the armed forces of the United States had shrunk from 12 million to 1.6 million personnel. Military parsimony was allowing the government to increase its expenditures to assist in European recovery. It was, he concluded, a calculated risk that would offer a prospect of eventually achieving national security. For his part, Truman thought it was only common sense to spend $20 or $30 billion to keep the peace over the coming 4 years than to spend multiples of that annually fighting a war. What made economic and financial aid such a radical alternative to a military buildup, however, was that the former had never been tried on such an enormous scale and in such a critical diplomatic confrontation. The administration knew from experience how to prepare for, fight, and win wars, but it was basing its new economic strategy on informed supposition and conviction. Who could say what it took to resuscitate economies in war-ravaged countries run by weak and embattled governments? Kennan, however, always emphasized that what the United States needed above all was a psychological advantage over the Soviet Union in the countries it targeted for assistance. Economic aid, he felt, was at least as much intended to revive a sense of purpose and self-reliance in recipient nations as it was to improve material conditions. Although administration policy would be resolute in opposing communism, it would not seek to impose an American orientation in return for assistance. But opposing communism could still be read as a hypocritical denial of choice. Acheson rationalized it. "I remember when it was accepted doctrine to say in the United States, we don't care if another country wants to be communist. That is all right. That is an internal matter. That is a matter for them to decide." It was only as we had more and more experience with communism that we learned it was not a doctrine which people picked up and looked over and either adopted or rejected. They were being coerced. Foreign coercion, however, did not imply that the United States itself needed to coerce. The conviction was widespread within the State Department that the ability of countries to resist Soviet pressure depended on their being independent and self-confident centers of power in their own right, and not wards of Washington. How, though, would the United States deal with governments that were communist but unallied with Moscow? The question would take on importance in the matter of Tito and communist Yugoslavia in 1948. Acheson would assert that it was in the obvious interest of the United States that Titoism be an erosive and disintegrating force in the Soviet sphere. The administration's East European chiefs of mission would conclude that any and all movements within world communism which tend to weaken and disrupt the Kremlin's control within the communist world represent forces which are operating in the interests of the West, and therefore should be encouraged and assisted. These statements made clear that it was Soviet influence, rather than communism as such, that the United States would oppose through the use of economic and political levers. Acheson's most public role in defining the Truman Doctrine came at the behest of the President. On April 7, 1947, Truman asked the Undersecretary for a favor. He had some time ago agreed, as a gesture to his wife's friends in Mississippi, to speak on foreign affairs at the Delta State Teachers College. But with the state's senior senator, Democratic Theodore Bilbo, fighting for reinstatement in the face of corruption charges, the president hoped to stay out of heated local politics. Marshall was unavailable as a substitute. Acheson was the host's third choice. Cleveland, Mississippi may not have been a hub for major foreign policy addresses, but Churchill had shown the year prior in Fulton, Missouri, that locality was no barrier to being heard nationally, or indeed globally. Acheson was anxious for a forum in which he could, invoking Clayton's word, help to shock the country into recognizing the economic crisis unfolding in Europe and America's self-interest in reversing it. Deputizing for the president on May 8th was as good an opportunity as he was ever going to get. Before leaving Washington, Acheson briefed British newsmen Leonard Mile, Malcolm Muggeridge, and Renee McCall over lunch, off the record, on the significance of what they would hear in Mississippi. His aim was to confront the growing fear in Britain and Western Europe that the United States had become misguidedly transfixed in the continent's southeast, blinded by the more overt military and political aspect of the conflicts there. Henry Wallace's campaign against the Truman Doctrine was making this task harder and more urgent. Acheson needed to reassert the president's broader message. It had been Acheson's idea for Truman's congressional address to be global in scope, but for his aid request to be limited to two countries, Greece and Turkey. Yet the drawbacks of this approach were by this time evident. The president's doctrine of March 12th had been broad enough in conception to contain the floodwaters, Jones noted. But the specific project of aid to Greece and Turkey had sandbagged only a tributary to the mainstream, which was now out of banks. France, Italy, and Britain were themselves falling into dire circumstances. Reconstruction was grinding to a halt. Food was no longer reaching the cities from the country. Factories were scrounging for vital raw materials. Gold and dollars with which to import essentials such as fuel were nearly evaporated. Strikes were spreading, inflation was mounting, and as the Moscow Foreign Ministers' Conference slogged on through April, it became clear that the Soviets were going to be part of the problem and not the solution. The starched patrician Acheson was not the natural envoy to send out into the cotton fields and cattle pastures of Mississippi, and yet he took to his assigned role ably. As he ambled out onto the hot, crowded college basketball court, listeners overflowing onto the grass outside, the undersecretary removed his coat, rolled up his sleeves, and using only notes he had scribbled onto the backs of his speech pages, looked directly into the sea of faces around him as he spoke. His contrivance lent his address the desired impromptu air, though he had memorized and barely deviated from the prepared text, conscious as he was of having a much wider audience. Acheson began by tying the rapidly deteriorating economic situation in Europe to elementals that were well understood in this rich agricultural region of the American heartland. "How short," he said, "is the distance from food and fuel to peace or to anarchy? factories destroyed, fields impoverished and without fertilizer or machinery to get them back in shape, transportation systems wrecked, populations scattered and on the borderline of starvation, and long-established business and trading connections disrupted. Europe was in danger. And the lack of a peace settlement, particularly as regards Germany, the great workshop of Europe, was holding back vital reconstruction. With Europe short on material and monetary resources to import even the most basic provisions essential to survival and rebuilding, American assistance efforts had been only in part suggested by humanitarianism. They were a matter of national self-interest. For until the various countries of the world get on their feet and become self-supporting, there can be no political or economic stability in the world, and no lasting peace or prosperity for any of us. Hopeless and hungry people, Acheson warned, often resort to desperate measures. The United States government, therefore, needed the authority and resources to act forcefully and expeditiously. Acheson spelled out how large the gap would be in the coming years between Europe's basic needs and its capacity to pay in dollars or gold. He then shepherded his listeners to the inevitable conclusion that they would have to accept more goods from abroad and to make sacrifices in consumption at home to ensure that the country could supply Europeans with items necessary to maintain their physical strength and carry on essential measures of reconstruction. Furthermore, the United States needed to take whatever action is possible immediately, even without full four-power agreement, to effect a larger measure of European, including German, recovery. This was code for saying that Soviet objections would not impede American action. European recovery, he insisted, cannot await compromise through exhaustion. And recovery could not take hold until the various parts of Europe's economy are working together in a harmonious whole. A coordinated European economy was therefore a fundamental objective of our foreign policy. Using American economic might to support human dignity, human freedom, and democratic institutions, he said in closing, is necessary if we are to preserve our freedoms and our own democratic institutions. It is necessary for our national security, and it is our duty and our privilege as human beings. The applause from the assembled was standing, generous, and polite, though it is doubtful that many understood the importance the administration vested in the speech. Truman later referred to it as the prologue to the Marshall Plan. Indeed, Acheson developed several of its essential elements here for the first time. In particular, the idea that Europe, or at least the Western part of it, needed to work as a harmonious whole was consequential. To that point, reconstruction efforts, such as they were uncoordinated and almost entirely national in scope. Acheson's emphasis on German industrial recovery was also a stark repudiation of the Morgenthau Plan. Soon after the speech, the Times' James Rustin, one of Acheson's favored newsmen, asked the undersecretary to clarify whether his speech represented new policy or just kite-flying. Acheson told him confidently to ask the president, which he did. Yes, Truman responded. The undersecretary spoke for him. Alarmed by Acheson's speech, Vandenberg demanded to see Marshall and the president. How could Acheson, he asked, call for a massive new foreign aid program? Marshall assured him that no new request for aid money would be forthcoming during the current session of Congress, but he wasn't going to lie. An aid bill would be coming his way in due course. This was not what the senator wanted to hear. He spoke regularly of bipartisan foreign policy as something precious and fragile, and he expected the president to do his part to keep it alive. Harry, he said to Truman, I want you to understand from now on that I'm not going to help you with crash landings unless I'm in on the takeoff. The two former Senate colleagues, who had never been close, would thereafter form a powerful political bond. Without it, the coming historic repositioning of U.S. foreign policy would not have been possible. Born 47 days apart in 1884, 63-year-old Vandenberg and Truman came from similar modest Midwestern backgrounds. Both saw their father's finances ruined at a young age, obliging them to work hard to keep their families fed. They were smart and loved words, but in different ways. Truman reading them, Vandenberg writing and speaking them. Truman boasted of reading all 3,000 books in the local library by the age of 14.